Blog Talk Radio.
And it's another edition of Talking Business with Ken Kreitzer. And we are sponsored by CVSI Services, the best in benefit programs and customer service management for the banking industry. And we're very pleased to have on the line with us tonight, all the way from Hong Kong, where it is morning, is Ruth Stevens. Ruth, how are you today?
Hey, great, Ken. I've just had the most delicious noodle breakfast. I'm all set and ready to chat.
Well, that's good. I know you've been on a terrific several-month trip. I know you're due home to New York in the next week or two. But just maybe recap your trip for our listeners. You've been to a couple of business conferences in Asia, and now you're teaching in Hong Kong. You've really covered a lot of ground.
That's right. Yes, I started in Malaysia and Bangkok, where I both gave a seminar in Malaysia and I attended a conference on business information in Bangkok, and then settled into 2 months of teaching in Hong Kong at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, which is a leading business school in Asia. They have a much larger university, but the business school has a pretty good reputation. And I've been teaching two electives, two MBAs, one elective called B2B Marketing and the other one called Customer Acquisition and Retention, which is basically database marketing used to manage the customer base as an asset to the firm. So I've been having a great time, terrific students. And because they're MBAs, they have several years of business under their belt, so the level of conversation is pretty high and very rewarding.
Well, that's terrific. Certainly an outstanding opportunity for you. Maybe you could just, in teaching business-to-business marketing, certainly I know you're an expert, have written texts on lead generating. What are some of the topics that you cover in your business-to-business course with your students in Hong Kong?
Well, it's been interesting because some of them are actually working in B2B environments, so they're pretty knowledgeable. Others have never even taken a marketing class, so they're pretty much newcomers, and I've had to try to balance that out. I was excited to be able to recruit a local businessman named Alex Orr to serve as a project contributor for the semester. Alex is in charge of Dolby Cinema. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this. It's many movie theaters have Dolby Sound and surround sound,
sure,
or whatever it's called, installed. But Dolby Cinema is a different product. It's a freshly built movie theater that has Dolby Sound throughout the entire floor, ceiling, walls, and the equipment is embedded in the entire environment. So it's a completely different experience. And Alex is in charge of taking Dolby Cinema into China. It's already been established. 40 theaters have already been built, and he needs to grow beyond those 40. So my students are spending the semester developing marketing strategies to help him do that. And on the last day of class next week, he and his colleagues are going to come in and listen to the students' suggestions for how to get more business in China. Very exciting project for them.
Well, that's terrific. Now, I guess one of the things that is such a different situation is that Hong Kong is a city state and it's right next to China. It's being absorbed into China over time. How do the people in your class feel their careers will progress starting in Hong Kong and then perhaps working in other parts of Asia?
Yeah. Well, the Hong Kongers themselves have pretty mixed feelings about the handover of Hong Kong 20 years ago to China. There's still 30 years of a 50-year special administrative relationship that guarantees certain freedoms to Hong Kongers, but will eventually be eliminated, and Hong Kong will just become a regular part of China. So some of the students are concerned about their careers in Hong Kong, but I actually have many mainlanders in my class, and also there are lots of Europeans and Canadians in the class as well. So it's a pretty mixed bag, and that's why the conversation it tends to be so interesting.
Oh, for sure. Now, tell us a little bit about how you teach your second course, Customer Acquisition and Retention, with your students in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I just had a terrific class last week. The course is one that I developed and have taught over, gosh, I think it's well over 10 years now. I've offered it at Columbia, at NYU Stern, in Singapore, and elsewhere. And so it's a pretty comprehensive review of how to acquire and retain customers profitably and add value to the market capitalization, shareholder value as a result. And it covers not only what needs to be in a marketing database, but also direct response communications, measurable communications that can record the history of the customer relationship, and some of the major applications of data-based marketing, like customer retention. And just last week, I had the neatest speaker come in. He's a fellow named King Leung, who's the CEO of a loyalty marketing agency here in Hong Kong. And he has developed loyalty programs for some local chain restaurants and other businesses in Hong Kong, and explained the thinking and the tactics that went into these loyalty programs over the last 5 or 6 years, and how they've evolved as consumers get used to a points program and need additional stimulation to continue being loyal and being repeat buyers. And what was especially great about this presentation from Mr. Leung was that the students told me afterward that it was the first time they had actually heard case examples from their own hometown, namely Hong Kong, because most of the speakers you might have in a class like that are likely to be either from outside be from China or Asia or Europe or the North America, because Hong Kong, having only 7 million population, is pretty small, and there's not necessarily the marketing innovation here that they've had a chance to be exposed to. So it was really a lucky opportunity for us to listen to a successful local marketing agency explain how they had engendered loyalty among customers of stores that the students in the class are also customers of. It was, you know, very real for them and very exciting.
Sure. Loyalty is something certainly we work on at CBSI with credit card accounts primarily. What are some of the other areas that loyalty programs can be applied to in the Asian market? You mentioned the retail stores. How do they apply that? Is that to their store card account, or what kind of account would a customer have of a retail store in Hong Kong?
Well, the most common is, no surprise, the simple card that a store will hand out. A lot of coffee shops use this. It's a physical card, and the customer brings it in and has it stamped every time they purchase. And, you know, after you've bought 10 cups of coffee, you get one free or something like that.
Like the old days here.
Yep, exactly. And King mentioned that as the low-cost traditional method for encouraging repeat purchase. But the stories that he told us that have really taken loyalty to the next level were really much more complicated and very interesting. I will mention, though, that financial institutions are also, I mean, not necessarily using points programs, but are definitely active in database marketing because they tend to have the data, and it's something that they're likely to be able to take advantage of. So it's an exciting opportunity. You know, you mentioned your sponsor in the banking world, and naturally that's active here too. But Mr. Leung talked about a case study from a few years ago for a grocery chain called Welcome that is pervasive here. It's sort of there are hundreds of stores.
The Starbucks of China.
It's not coffee. It's groceries. But he said he'd also developed a program for Manning's, which is a drugstore chain, and these are both pretty standard loyalty schemes where you get points. But what he was particularly excited about was a gamification strategy that had been developed for Pizza Hut that allowed was delivered in the form of an app that could connect not only the purchases but also bigger data from the environment, namely weather. And the app allowed customers to be notified through the app with offers based on not only their purchase history and whatever promotions Pizza Hut wanted to offer, but also, pretty interestingly, weather-based promotions. So, for example, the one that he shared with us was a promotion that related to a cold front that was coming in, and they set up a triggered campaign that kept an eye on the expected weather any given day in Hong Kong. And when the temperature was expected to drop that morning to a certain degree of coldness, that would trigger to certain customers based on a variety of behavioral and demographic factors an offer to come in and have a delicious hot meal, like, I don't know, chocolate lava cake or some kind of warm soup or something like that, relating to the cold weather. And it was particularly neat because it was sort of set and forget on Pizza Hut's side, meaning they could develop the campaign on a triggered basis in advance and just wait for the temperature outside to reach the right level, and the campaign would just be sent off. And apparently it was extremely successful and also won some prizes in local marketing programs.
Yes. When you're talking about retail in Hong Kong and in the Asian market, obviously mobile phones is a big factor. And do you find mobile payments is something that has taken hold in place of other, let's say, a debit card or a credit card? How do you see mobile payments advancing in your stops in Asia?
they're way ahead of us, Ken. It's amazing. Just in the last 2 years, China, the mainland, has basically gone cashless for micropayments. Even the lowliest hawker stand on the street selling, you know, 20 cents worth of food or some tiny item will accept mobile payments mostly through WeChat, which is the Chinese version of Facebook. And it's actually a lot more sophisticated than Facebook, frankly, functionality-wise.
Really?
Or through Alibaba's Alipay service, which is sort of similar to PayPal. So China has sort of leapfrogged over everybody else by jumping from cash directly to mobile payments. Hong Kong is still using a payment system called Octopus, which is very similar to the cash card that you find in the UK, which is primarily designed for transportation, but can also be used for small payments, small and maybe even large, but I think there's an upward limit. You can use your Octopus card in Hong Kong, not only for transport, but also to buy, you know, incidentals and you can pay a grocery checkout, but it's all prepaid. You have to pay in, top up the card and work it down instead of having it come directly out of your bank account. So in payment terms or payment systems terms, it's not the latest at all. So Hong Kongers are expecting that their environment will quickly migrate within a year or so away from the Octopus card, which is a plastic card, to virtual payment systems using the phone the way China has.
And I'm just curious, what kind of advice would someone in China who has an account for the first time, what kind of device, a mobile device, would they have? Is it a fairly simple mobile phone that is widely able to be utilized?
Yeah, smartphone. They're smartphones, really. Flip type phones are passé. These vendors who are offering WeChat style payments to their customers are all on smartphones, but they're Chinese made inexpensive smartphones that are mass marketed. At the high end, of course, the iPhone is very popular in China, but it's only available to the upper middle and upper classes who can afford it. The broader population is using a Chinese-made smartphone.
Okay. Now, you mentioned having guest speakers in your class. Any other speakers or key topics that have come up in your classes that you're teaching in Hong Kong?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. In my business-to-business class last week, we had a really excellent speaker from Deutsche Bank, a fellow named Sandeep Sethi, who is in charge of customer relationships for about 20 key accounts in the region. These are, you know, large accounts. As you can imagine, Deutsche Bank is being, is operating at a pretty high B2B level. He's responsible for the Deutsche Bank relationship with Siemens, AT&T, Philip Morris, Carlsberg, and other large enterprises. And I invited him to come in and explain how a sales and marketing department like his strategizes account penetration or deepening the relationship. And he shared with us about a dozen very interesting strategies about product bundling, about cross-selling, referral marketing, looking at data about customer behavior in one account and carrying it over to marketing strategies for another account. And when I asked him what marketing communications are most helpful in his department, which is a regional operation, he's covering the whole Asian region for these accounts. He said it was face-to-face events, and that his marketing department does almost 100% of their activity in organizing opportunities for these key accounts to enjoy peer-to-peer event programs that will attract the seniorest decision makers and allow the Deutsche Bank sales team to have a lot of quality time with their current customers and prospects. So it was a reminder that in the B2B world, you know, all of the marketing communication, all the digital marketing communications in the world are never going to take the place of business events as a go-to-market strategy. So,
yes, face-to-face marketing, we always believe in that. And certainly sounds like, you know, taking customers to a golf tournament, a tennis tournament, a baseball game, a football game might be part of it. Is there equivalence in Hong Kong to some of the kind of some of the premium sports or entertainment places you might take a business client to in the United States?
Is there ever? I'm so glad you brought it up, because just this last weekend, Saturday and Sunday, Hong Kong was host for the second time to a so-called E Formula One. E stands for electric, and it was all 100% electric vehicles, very sporty.
Wow.
Vehicles running a Formula One type race on the streets of the city over the weekend, with, you know, viewing stands and pretty expensive grandstand ticket prices. And it was, when I got wind of it and thought I might pop over, the tickets were all sold out. So I'm sure that was big in the business world, and lots of people. Lots of companies invited their top clients to that event. But more frequently, Hong Kong has horse racing in a neighborhood of Hong Kong Island called Happy Valley every Wednesday night. And the horse race grounds have been built with very elaborate skyboxes and entertainment areas where you can host customers, have a lovely meal and drinks, and watch the horse racing from above. And that's also a very popular business event venue.
Very good. And we're talking with Ruth Stevens, who is a direct marketing, digital marketing, business-to-business consultant based in New York, but is spending a couple of months in Asia, visiting different conferences and teaching in Hong Kong. Ruth, tell our audience, just highlight your business, working on business-to-business, and your work. You're an author of several texts.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, I've been a consultant in B2B marketing, mostly sales lead generation and database marketing, for 17 years now. Oh, my God. 17 years, and really enjoyed working with clients ranging from industrial and technology manufacturers to business services. I have a lovely client in Japan I've been working for a couple of years, and I'm also working for some marketing services providers in the U.S. whom I advise on marketing strategy. And The three books that I've written about B2B marketing, the first one was on trade show and event marketing. That was actually the title of the book. And my second was Maximizing Lead Generation, which I think you're familiar with, Ken. And my most recent book, co-authored with Theresa Kushner, who was a colleague of mine at IBM years ago, she and I produced a book called B2B Data-Driven Marketing that came out last year. So thanks for the chance to plug my books. Appreciate it.
That's right. Now, I know you mentioned a client in Japan and that you spent a little time recently on your trip in Japan. What was your impressions of Japan on this visit?
I had four lovely days in Japan a few weeks ago. I did two seminars there. One was for a direct marketing agency and printing services association. The other one was for my client, Symphony Marketing, which is the leading demand gen agency in Japan focused on business to business. Their clients are all industrial manufacturers, and most of them have international distribution and business opportunities. So as a provider of consulting services, I help their clients develop ideas for how to do better in foreign, non-Japanese markets. But the seminar that I did for them this last visit attracted about 80 of their customers, and I had the chance to talk about three topics. One was trends in B2B marketing in the U.S. today. I also introduced two case studies about how two foreign companies, one of whom is a Japanese company, had achieved market leadership in the U.S., trying to inspire the Japanese manufacturers for how they too could be more effective in the U.S. market. And then third, I talked about some predictions about where B2B marketing is headed in the future. And I had the most wonderful experience for a 90-minute presentation. It was in a large semicircular room where sort of looked like an MBA classroom. And we had...
Yeah, I think I saw one of the pictures.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a set of translators who did concurrent interpretation of my talk, which made it so easy for me because everyone in the room could have a little earpiece, just like, you know, the United Nations, and listen to what I was saying in real time instead of having a sequential translation, which makes it very choppy and difficult to concentrate. So the talk went really well, and the respondents gave it very, very positive feedback. What I thought was so interesting, though, Ken, was of all of the topics that I covered, one of the most controversial or the one that prompted some of the most difficult questions was the subject of GDPR, which is this onerous new set of data protection regulations that are coming out of Europe next May.
Right.
And we marketers around the world have been warned, you know, to get ready for this over the last 2 years. And I explained to the audience a bit about what the GDPR is all about. It's actually not much more onerous than Japan's own data protection regulations, which are frankly very similar to the EU. So Japan is already in that world. But what's challenging non-EU marketers is questions like, does our data about EU customers and prospects need to be housed in the EU? And of course, the answer is no, it can be housed elsewhere, but you have to demonstrably be able to show that you have received a positive opt-in that you can prove from your EU data subjects. And that is a pretty tough requirement. The US is nowhere near that because we're operating in an opt-out world. And a whole bunch of services have sprung up to help marketers comply with this, like there are call centers in Ireland that will take your entire marketing database of EU names and phone in and record the call and be able to weed out the clients that are not opting in, but also deliver the clients that have agreed to receive marketing communications and also to allow their names to be listed in your database. So the Japanese audience was surprised to learn the data that I presented from Forrester, who I don't know, Ken, if you have heard about this before, but Forrester had recently, just a few weeks ago, had predicted that 80% of companies are going to fail to comply with GDPR in 2018.
Wow.
This was reported by MarTech Today. It's pretty easy to find on Google. But Forrester had done some pretty broad research among companies and found that that 80% say they're either unwilling or unable to comply with with the regulations by May. And of them, this is what really interested me, of them, 50%, namely 40% of companies, are intentionally not complying, meaning they've said, look, this is just too onerous. We don't think the risk of noncompliance is worth the investment. We're just simply not going to comply.
Is there any track record on what the fee, what the fines or penalties might be for noncompliance? In the U.S., the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
There's no track record yet. The EU regulators have stated that the penalties will be extremely harsh, namely 4% of top line global revenue is the potential fine. So for a global company like, I don't know, any global company, 4% of top line revenue represents millions, billions of dollars. So
it'll be more than what they would have generated
concept
in the EU.
No, it's global revenue. It's not just EU revenue. But
that's
here's the reason,
out, yeah.
At least I think, the reason that, I'm hypothesizing the reason that these respondents to the Forrester study include a large number of companies who say they're not going to bother is that the EU is likely to make an example of somebody, but they're not going to go. I guess these companies are betting that the EU is not going to go seeking compliance from 100% of the companies that are doing business in the EU. So they're saying, okay, I'm guessing that I'm not going to be a target of the regulators. So this sort of threw the audience into a bit of a consternation. I mean, Japan is an extremely rules-driven society, and for an audience of Japanese marketers to hear that some of their colleagues around the world have decided to throw in the towel was came as quite a shock. It's quite an interesting discussion.
Certainly. When your students ask about American companies and possibly some, you know, the leading companies like Google or Amazon or Microsoft. What do they say? Are the American companies, the you mentioned a couple already that are participating in Hong Kong. Are they admired as much as they had been a few years ago?
So we're not talking about Japan now. We're talking about Hong Kong, are we?
Oh, back in Hong Kong in your classes when the students ask about American companies, some of the major names in the internet, in digital marketing, and in other fields. What are the ones that they view positively, you know, as far as the technology and the capability that they're bringing to an Asian market?
Okay, very, really interesting question. It's so mixed. I would say uniformly Apple is widely respected and, in fact, beloved in, throughout Asia. But, you know, looking at Apple CEO's attendance at a major Chinese conference last week, it's pretty clear that they have chosen a very cooperative political and business approach to the greater China market. That said, you know, consumers love Apple products. Now, Facebook, on the other hand, has actually such an interesting mix of consumer reaction because if you ask any given Hong Konger, do you have a Facebook account? I don't know what the exact percentage is, but every hand in the room will rise. That Facebook is used in business and personal, used personally throughout Hong Kong as a basic standard. But Facebook is banned in China, and you can say the same of Google, or at least Google's search. Google's search engine capability. So this is part of the
reason. So Google search is banned in China too. Interesting.
Yeah, Google search is banned there, and the Chinese have their own, you know, approved search engines that are completely controllable and. What's the word, censorable by the Chinese government, and very actively they have tens of thousands of censors who scour the web pages today and simply block what they find inappropriate or offensive. So Google and Facebook are both extremely popular in Hong Kong, but are unavailable except through workarounds like virtual private networks in China. So, and as I said earlier, China's own answer to Facebook, namely WeChat, has superior functionality to Facebook. It has wonderful scheduling systems, excellent payment systems, superb messaging. Facebook Messenger is still pretty weak. So I believe that when, well, in 30 years, who knows what's going to happen in 30 years. But
yeah, a lot of things, a lot of technology will change, and certainly how countries interact will have changed by then. Any other, we're talking with Bruce Stevens, New York-based digital marketing, business-to-business consultant, spending a couple of months in Asia this fall, visiting different areas and teaching. Ruth, just we'll wrap up in a minute. I think we went overtime tonight, and it's fascinating to hear about your trip. Is there anything different that is you notice about the cities that you visited in Asia on this trip from prior trips?
Well, as a Samsung Android phone holder, I found this trip much easier than prior trips for me personally, because my cell phone service provider has a plan that allows me complete global, almost. There's some countries that where it's not available, but most countries I have complete data access. So other than voice to voice calls, I can go anywhere and do anything without Wi-Fi, or I can also use Wi-Fi. So my experience has been superb this year as I've used local messaging apps like WhatsApp and WeChat and Line, which is a Japanese, or very popular in Japan, social network. It's just so liberating to be able to communicate and research information from, you know, your fingertips, no matter where you are. So that's just a personal message or personal experience of my own.
Well, very good. Now, Ruth, we appreciate your time and filling us in on your trip and what the conversations have been like in your classes and your talks with business leaders in Asia. Is there a final thought you have for us?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to returning to New York on December 18th, but I also am really impressed with the energy and optimism in Asia. Despite what's going on in our country politically, there's an enormous amount of excitement and positivity out here in Asia. So it's fun to be in this environment, and I'm going to miss it.
Well, I bet you'll find a way to make another trip in the coming years. And no, it sounds exciting. It sounds like you're doing a lot of interesting work teaching and describing the know-how from here in the United States and from our own marketing, digital marketing community. You've been such a good sponsor and leader in the Direct Marketing Club of New York and other the Direct Marketing Association, Data and Marketing Association, and many other groups in the United States. So just want to say thank you for your insight and sharing your trip with us, and best wishes on your return home to New York in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Ken.
Great. Ruth Stevens calling in from Hong Kong, and we wish her well on the balance of her trip and returning to New York shortly. And Ruth, we'll talk soon, and thank you again.
Okay. So long.
Have a good evening. This is Ken Kratzer signing off for Talking Business, sponsored by CBSI Services, providing benefit programs to the consumer banking industry and managing customer service for our clients. So that's all for tonight, and we'll have another episode very soon. Thank you for listening.